Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode, a live episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see you. And it just so happens that this episode falls on Halloween. So I'm glad that you two got into the spirit of Halloween. What'd you guys dress up as? You're pretty scary right now. So, at some point during the show, you need to take those masks off. So, but it's always good to see you. I think we've got an interesting show because, of course, we get comments from our viewers, questions, and things like that that we're going to be addressing today. But before we get started, you may see a little bit of grizzle here. Having spent some really 12 years, 13 years dealing with issues of thyroid cancer, men's health is a big issue. And years past, of course, it was No Shave November, which was to bring at least awareness to men's health. And so I still honor that today. Fortunately, I have been cancer-free, but I do monitor my health very closely since I travel all over the world, like both of you. And you just never know. And unfortunately, I know of some folks that recently passed away due to health issues. So for all the male pilots out there, of course, you need to go out and really pay attention to your health. As pilots, we need to be in our best physical condition, both mentally and physically. And so it is a good idea to monitor your health, especially when it comes to prostate cancer and other forms of cancer. So I just wanted to get that plug in because, again, I'm on the road all the time. I still fly actively, and I do monitor my health very thoroughly. So good to see you guys. And I know, Todd, that you are at least our purveyor of the emails and the comments that we get on this show. So with that, I will turn it over to you to start the ball rolling with us trying to answer some of our listener and viewer questions.
Well, thank you for that. And before I get into the questions, I have to thank all of you who have left questions and comments on our many videos. And we have, my gosh, over 300 of these so far. And there are plenty of good questions. And our problem is we have so many good questions and interesting questions, it's hard to pick from them. So let me start with one that isn't about the particular show it was from. This is from episode 296, where we discuss updates on the Washington National crash details and also discuss Air India. And for, I can't remember what we said in that show, but there was a question in there where one of our listeners, Chronograph 71, asked, stated, "I was absolutely disgusted by your use of Gulf of America. That felt like Russia or North Korea, a country with censorship." I won't go into the rest of the comment, but the question inside of that was, why are you using the current term Gulf of Mexico and not Gulf of America? Now, those of you who are regular listeners to our show have probably heard me talk about this before, but I'll talk about it again. The thing that got me interested in discussing it was when I was looking up accidents in the Gulf of, formerly known as the Gulf of Mexico, for oil rig accidents, I went to the NTSB website, looked by state and province, and there was no Gulf of Mexico anymore, just Gulf of America, which meant anyone who's looking for historical events involving especially helicopters on oil rigs in the Gulf would have a much harder time trying to sift through the database than would have been the case if they used both terms. So that was my first issue with it. And more generally, I said to myself, what are the rules? What actually changed? Turns out there was an executive order from the Office of the President, which essentially said, changed the name to Gulf of America. And here's the key part. For those parts of the current Gulf that are on the continental shelf close to the United States. So in essence, the Office of the President, unofficially, I say unofficially because it wasn't passed by Congress, it's an executive order, changed the name, but only for part of the Gulf. So realistically, well over 90% of the Gulf is still the Gulf of Mexico. Practically, we have a global audience. And if we talk about something happening in the Gulf, oil rigs, etc., we're going to use both terms because we want to communicate to people where we're talking about. So if there is a change legally, if the Congress legally changes the name of the entire Gulf to Gulf of America, that'll be another issue we'll discuss later. But globally, this is not the first time where there are bodies of water with more than one name. Those of you who are of a certain age remember the Persian Gulf, also known as the Arabian Gulf, depending on circumstance and who's doing the description. So this is one of those situations where, yes, the name has been changed by some entities. The world knows it by something else. We're going to use both terms.
That demonstrates the detail that we go to in making sure that we are factually correct. And so, again, this is a good demonstration. You did a lot of research. I know you've talked about it in the past. And again, we try to make things vanilla and use a term, you know, and it covers everything, just like aviation safety. Aviation safety is a vanilla term. But what does that really encompass? So you did a good job with the research on that and the explanation.
That, you know, there's so many people just pick on words here and there. It's just, and lose sight of the big picture, what we're trying to convey, the message that we're trying to give to people, the awareness, and they just focus in on 2-3 words. It's sometimes I think that's so counterproductive.
Yeah. What do you got for us next?
Well, like I said, we had plenty of questions. My problem was choosing from them. And the next one is coming from episode 287. This was one where we discussed a crash involving a Cirrus where there were decisions made by the pilot. The plane ended up crashing short of fuel, short of the airport, rather. And the question or this comment was, we should be taking the biannual flight reviews more seriously, documenting in-flight decision-making and attitudes toward unexpected circumstances. Low-time pilots go years and decades without having a serious situation develop, and they could be the next high-performance, complex, or twin buyer who is not ready for the upgrade. So the question I saw within that was, should biannual flight reviews incorporate realistic situations to test pilot decision-making in unexpected circumstances? And I like this question because Greg is the one person in the flight safety detectives who is a CFI and who has trained people, instrument, single engine, twin engine, etc. You can answer this question better than any one of us can.
Well, I could take the rest of this show just to talk about it. I sit on the board of the National Association of Flight Instructors, and one of the frustrating things, of course, is the depth and breadth and quality of these, what to, as Prince would say, formerly known as Prince. This is formerly known as a biennial flight review. It is just now called a flight review that has to be executed within the next or following 24 months. But when you read 6156, which is the whole discussion in the regulations about what a flight review should encompass, the problem I have is that the flight review criteria, you have to have an hour of ground and an hour of flight instruction, but the reg allows the flight instructor to make the determination as to what's covered. I don't necessarily like that. only because, I mean, you could be covering some very superfluous things, especially if you have somebody or it's a friend or an acquaintance. You're going to go up there and just yank and bank around the pattern and call it good and get signed off. That's not quality. And that's not in answer to our viewers' question with regard to the depth and breadth of really examining the person who is coming for this flight review. The biggest thing is, I think that there should be an established core for both ground instruction and in flight instruction as far as the maneuvers are concerned. Then at the discretion of the flight instructor, it's like a la carte. You have the primary menu item. This is going to be, you know, the basics for ground and flight instruction. And then you can a la carte additional maneuvers and information as you deem necessary. But to leave it to the discretion, especially given the fact that we have a lot of young flight instructors, many of which, unfortunately, I'm working a number of accidents involving fatal flight instruction and student accidents. It's a demonstration that these folks really don't understand aviation. And not to belittle anybody, but when you got a 300-hour CFI, what do they really know about giving an annual flight review, especially to somebody who's got maybe 4,000 or 5,000 hours, has been flying their own airplane for 5 years? So I agree, it has to be better quality, but the instructor has to be better quality as well in their determination of what is relevant for both ground and flight instruction, and it's not really flight instruction, it is flight review. So you're observing the performance of maneuvers and really evaluating the depth of knowledge of the candidate who's come in for that flight review to determine and make sure that they are very conversant with regulations. They can perform these maneuvers. And again, I've preached this in the past. You go and you use the ACS or the PTS, which still exists for some of the certificates and ratings. But the FAA uses a term called mastery. They don't say proficiency. They don't say understanding. They say mastery. And if you look up that definition, it is well beyond proficiency. And that's what we need to be evaluating. Does the candidate demonstrate both orally with their level of knowledge and then tactily, if you will, when we're doing maneuvers in the air, do they demonstrate that with a level of mastery? And I agree, we need better quality reviews as well. So,
well, thank you for that. And I'll take this opportunity to go to the next question, which I'm going to take directly. This is from episode 168, quite some time ago, but it's mentioning something that's common for all of our videos. The question from Denver Brawler 3948 is: green screens are not expensive. Have you looked at your own videos? You need proper backdrops. Okay, first off, yes, I have looked at the videos. And full disclosure, I'm actually the person responsible for editing many of the videos. So if the video quality is questionable, I'm the guy to look at. But the question within that is, why does your podcast look so low budget? Well, because it is. Why? We're honest here. We focus on ideas, insights, inspiration, and that is based on what we share, and that's mostly with words. And yes, our graphics are, how should I say it, stuck in the 1990s as far as the internet's concerned, but here's our opportunity to correct that. We like sponsors. We would love to have sponsors. And if you're a person who is involved in a company or an organization that's involved in aviation and aviation safety, and you want to support us, give us a call, or rather, give us an email at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We will work with you to bring your idea, your product, your service to our audience, which, thanks to the support of all the people who watch and all the people who send questions, is a growing audience. And if we have a large enough influx of funding, we will get a green screen. Now, will I actually be able to use a green screen technically? That's a whole different question, but we will buy a green. You can sponsor a green screen. Yes. For a low price of whatever you can handle, we will get a green screen and I'll put it behind me.
Todd, I want people to at least support us, sponsor us, so that we can have our own formal studio.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I want. So then the three of us can be actually in the same room, and I can start throwing things at you two when I don't agree. That'll make it more entertaining.
And I'll have a personal protective equipment to protect myself from the slings and arrows of outrageous comments.
There you go.
Now, we have a not so outrageous comment or not so outrageous question, one that's actually quite relevant to many of the events we've actually discussed. This is from episode 291. As some of you may recall, this is the episode where we discuss a helicopter pilot in Australia who, under the heavy influence of alcohol, had some issue where he felt that he had to fly low altitude around the city, and at the end of the flight crashed into a building and unfortunately died. And there were questions that were unanswered about what was going on with this person. Yes, there was alcohol, but the big question is, what caused this person to drink the alcohol? The question from Bunglejoy 3645, yes, mental health, but what about pilots who have mild dementia? The question I saw within that is, what are the effects of mild dementia on a pilot's ability to fly an airplane? Now, for many of you out there, you've dealt with a situation that didn't involve aviation, but involved driving an automobile. Many of you know of a close relative or a friend of a close relative where they've had an issue where the person who's driven all their lives enjoys driving, experiences a sense of freedom and joy from driving, and it's a necessary part of their life, gets to the point where they shouldn't be driving. Yet the laws are such where, in most cases, no one can force them to give up their driver's license. And I feel that that's a situation that's similar in aviation. Those who fly go out of their way to do so. It's not something that's easy. It's something that you have to work hard for and to remain proficient at. And who is the best judge of someone's own capabilities, that person or an outsider? Usually an outsider. But when the outsider says something that person doesn't like, they can tell them to go pound sand. And again, this is something where, Greg, as a CFI, you very likely have faced this situation directly or indirectly many times. So, you know, given that we have medical privacy in this and many other countries, you can't dive into the medical records. None of us here in the show are medical doctors, but we can see a lack of capability or the reduction in capability when we come across it. So in your situation, how do you approach someone with apparent mental deficits, be it dementia or something else?
And it is a very good question. Of course, mental health is risen to the top and gotten into the spotlight, especially since we've seen the accidents that we've talked about on this show with Air India and Germanwings and Silk Air and a variety of other accidents where the accidents were attributed to an intentional act by one or more crew members. Anybody that has any kind of mental health issue is questioned by the FAA whether or not they are capable and competent to be able to at least operate the aircraft. But I think it goes further because it goes under the wing as well. So if we look at this mild dementia, what's mild dementia? What's the baseline? Because what may be mild dementia in one person may be severe or significant dementia in another. So it's hard to quantify that. But the fact is if there is any type of evidence of dementia, that person, whether they fly it, fix it, or manage it, shouldn't be doing anything that could compromise aviation safety.
And we have obviously situations where pilots might have mental issues. And some pilots, not all, actually have to go get checked every once in a while from an aerospace medical examiner, an AME, and make sure that they are fit to fly. Now, currently, we also have another level of medical checkup, basic med, which is not as extensive as an AME, and it doesn't have to have an FAA-authorized physician to sign off on it. Then we have types of flying where no license is needed. For example, back in the day when I was flying hang gliders, I didn't need a license to fly a hang glider. And it was a solo flight every time I did it. And the people who were training me were not officially authorized or certificated by the FAA. So it was like a, you know, we looked at each other and, hey, if we like the cut of their jib, I'd have them as my instructor. If they like the cut of my jib, they'd let me fly the hang glider. But for more specifically, basic med is something that is a broadly used option for getting medically certified to fly certain kinds of aircraft. And Greg, what are some of the issues you see, potential issues, especially with mental health and dementia, that comes with having either a lower level of medical authorization or no level of medical authorization in order to fly?
There's a lot of controversy right now, Todd, with regard to basic med. While it was really developed to allow more people to experience flying, which I'm all for, the problem is that once you're flying under basic med, you have no oversight. That is, you are the oversight, if you will, of yourself. You're supposed to do, as all pilots are supposed to do, I am safe, and a number of other self-evaluations to determine if you're fit to fly. Well, it's real easy to justify, well, I don't really feel good today, but I still want to go aviate. And you'll justify why you're going to go fly. Now, with the requirement of having a medical certificate where somebody's going to examine you and make that determination, whether at least at that point, time, and space when you go in for your medical, that you are in physically good shape, that you know you're all together. I mean, that's really one of the purposes when you go into an AME and they start chatting you up about a variety of things. They're doing an assessment of, are you here on Earth with us or are you out, you know, in space somewhere? That's part of their overall evaluation of you before they issue any kind of medical certificate. But once you get into basic med, now you're the self-certifying authority, if you will, and you have to do these self-assessments. Well, again, if something starts to develop on the first day that you got your basic med and starts to get worse throughout the course of months or years within that five-year period, all of a sudden now, who's going to know? Who's going to see it? And it's a catch me if you can. Meanwhile, it's a compromise to safety, not only to your own personal safety or the safety of the people that you may be flying, but to the safety of people on the ground. Because if that airplane comes down or that helicopter comes down in a place that it's not supposed to be, you've now jeopardized their safety as well. As a flight instructor, I would love to be able to evaluate people that I'm flying with, not from the standpoint of having to analyze them as a trained psychologist, but is there something going on today with you that could adversely affect the way you operate and we fly? I mean, everybody has a one-off, okay? Yes, you may have had a relative that recently passed away. You're not really there. You're kind of depressed. Okay, that I understand. Those are short-term type things. But when long-term basic mental health issues start to develop, as a flight instructor, how can I evaluate that? Again, not to do any kind of analysis on you, but maybe say, hey, you need to go see somebody about this just to make sure you're okay and we are comfortable flying together. Because if you're not there, it's a waste of your time trying to do something that I'm asking you to do. It's a waste of my time to fly with you if you're not going to be able to perform.
Well, this segues easily into a related question that we had from another viewer. This is from episode 289, where we talked about a 12-day period where there were multiple accidents that the NTSB was investigating. And one of the comments from, this is from Charles Faure, F-A-U-R-E, I hope I'm doing that right. Charles Faure, 1189, long comment and included, there's no justification for spending large amounts of time and effort to meticulously investigate pilot stupidity, which is by far the most common reason for GA accidents. No number of lessons will impress feckless pilots who ignore the innumerable lessons that are already on record. And the question I saw within there is, oh, he said, the root problem is there are people holding certificates who shouldn't be, and the lack of follow-up oversight after certification, a lack of requirements for ongoing training aren't going to change. The question in that is, would safety improve if there is more periodic testing of all certificated pilots? Greg, you and I are both certificated pilots. You far more, expert than I'll ever be, in my opinion. But should we have more testing? You on the high end, me on the low end of experience.
Testing is like statistics. I can manipulate that. I could have a test every month and be prepped for that test, perform the test, successfully pass the test, and then go back to my old ways. I don't think it's necessarily testing, but starting with the beginning of those comments, pilot stupidity. If you go to the NTSB website and you put in, you know, the keywords pilot stupidity, you won't find any accident attributed to pilot stupidity. And given the fact that I'm a pilot and you're a pilot, Todd, the last thing I want to be called is stupid. Yes. Does it sound like a waste of time and a waste of government money for us to go out and look at accidents that are repetitive in nature? Yes, to an extent. But in order for us to do thorough and methodical investigations for the bottom line purpose of enhancing aviation safety, you have to conduct an accident or an incident investigation, develop all the facts, conditions, and circumstances to determine whether or not there were issues involved with the aircraft. Were there anomalous or malfunctions or failures of any of the systems on the aircraft that put a pilot into a position where they had to use a variety of different skills to be able to successfully get that aircraft back on the ground? We've seen engine failures. We've seen loss of power. We've seen flight control issues that were benign. Why I call it benign is because an engine failure, we train to engine failures. It's a prescriptive thing. You lose power, you immediately push the nose over, attain your best glide speed, pick a place, go through procedures. We are trained to do that. That's a benign event. When it turns into a catastrophic event is when pilots aren't prepared to be able to take that necessary action for which they've been trained. That's the problem. And when, in especially right now, as we are churning out pilots to supposedly fulfill this pilot shortage, we are not training them to a level of understanding. We're training them to a level of knowledge. And the demonstration of that knowledge, which is supposed to be to a higher level, according to the FAA, as I said before, mastery, that's not being demonstrated. We have a lot of good designated pilot examiners out there, a lot of whom are friends of mine, who just shake their head going, I can't believe these people of all certificate and rating levels are coming in for a check ride and they don't make it out the door because, one, they don't know how to read a logbook. They can't demonstrate that the aircraft is airworthy just from looking at the logbook. Guess what? They're not going on a check ride if they don't know that. And then on top of that, all the excuses that either the candidate has given or the flight instructor who recommended them is trying to give to the DPE to go, well, you know, yeah, we did talk about that, but maybe, but don't worry about it. They'll learn that. Let them keep going. It doesn't work that way. And it is about quality, not quantity. Unfortunately, because we are churning out young flight instructors, and it doesn't matter your age. I'm talking about young as far as experience. We have all of these flight instructors out there that don't have a lot of practical experience putting forth students that go for a check ride and they don't fail. I mean, they aren't successful on their check rides for a variety of different reasons. We have to improve that quality. And there has been talk in the past that the FAA should take back the responsibility of certifying flight instructors. Because again, it is the quality of the flight instructor that's going to be the quality of the student or pilot candidate that goes forth for any particular check ride. So, I mean, it is one of those things that we could talk back and forth for hours and debate. But again, it's all about the quality.
But the same could be asked for the maintenance side of the house. And here's where I'd like to bring in John on this. I mean, our previous viewer was talking about whether or not there should be, you know, additional testing of pilots. As many of you know, maintenance professionals have to go through FAA certification as well. A difficult process, takes a while to do so. And once they are in the system, they can go and do work on your airplane or the airliner you're flying on. But John, in the maintenance side of the house, how does recertification or retesting on the FAA level work? Or is there a completely different way that the capability of that aviation maintenance technician is tested?
Well, it is completely different, but in some ways it's similar. So at some point, if you get the qualifications, you have to be qualified to sit for the FAA test. And that means either on-the-job training for 3 years or going through a school, approved maintenance school. At the end of that, you can sit and take the written test. If you pass the written test, the next step is a oral and a practical test. So you've demonstrated that you know the rules, you know the procedures, and now you have to show that you have the eye and hand coordination, essentially, to turn the wrenches and accomplish certain tasks. And since A&P has to cover a huge number of work areas, you might get welding. You have, on the airframe side, you get welding. They would no longer do dope and fabric, but I long contended that that should have morphed into composites. And you physically have to be able to verbally explain what you're doing as well as doing it. And there's some problems in that area too with this younger generation.
But John, you know that unlike, flying and being a pilot, where we're going back for a flight review every 24 months, what are the mechanics required to do once they get their AMP?
They're not required to go back, but they are required to be able to read and write and understand the maintenance manual. And the writing portion is to be able to put that in the logbook or some other record of the work that you've done. So you need to do that. If you haven't done a job before, previously, and in recent past, not done it 50 years ago, like it would be in my case, you need to go back and read the manual, and you have to be able to understand it. If you can't articulate that, if you get a visit by the FAA while the work is going on, if you can't articulate that, then you could have a problem with the FAA, with enforcement, because you're not qualified to accomplish that task. Now, in large maintenance organizations, depending where you are, if you're in a heavy maintenance environment, you have task documents, step-by-step task documents. So almost anybody can do those jobs just by following those documents. But there's more than half of this work that mechanics do is not covered by those documents. So it requires you to be able to find things in the manual, understand them, be able to articulate them, and accomplish them the way the manual says you're supposed to do it. So it's sometimes not easy on a mechanic. And I'm hearing and seeing that the quality of some of the guys that are getting through the system leaves a lot to be desired.
When we were talking about one of the questions that came in from a viewer was regarding mild dementia. And we got talking, Todd and I got talking about the mental health aspect. And while, yes, the focus is especially right now on mental health with pilots, what's the focus on mental health with maintenance technicians?
Essentially, it's zero. And it needs to be. The problems that we see from my point of view, the problems that I see with pilots in the cockpit, I see not only in the maintenance facilities that I visit and people that I worked with, I see it with management people in those facilities. I see it in people on the ramp that load airplanes and dispatch. So, we're all people. We're all the same. And those kinds of problems that we see in the cockpit will definitely morph into the rest of the operation.
And finish this particular question. An invitation to all those who are watching this show who are in any way, shape, or form involved in aviation professionally, especially if you're a certificated person in aviation. What are the things that you think should be done or aren't being done or being done too much with respect to making sure that you're able to do the particular job you're doing? Could be a flight attendant, could be an air traffic controller, could be a dispatcher, could be like, John, look, I'm saying a ramp worker. Are you getting the attention or the oversight, or your colleagues getting the attention and oversight you think they deserve? So if you have questions, please either write us directly or leave them as a comment under one or more of our videos. And
before we get off the subject, I want to just clear something up on the ramp. Many people think they just throw bags. They're just putting bags in the belly of the airplane. But we have crashed more than one airplane because the airplane was loaded improperly. And too much weight in the front, but too much weight in the back, and the rest of it. That job is not insignificant. In fact, I can make a case that there is absolutely no job in servicing an airplane that's not critical. Every single one can have negative consequences. But some people always think that, oh, he's just throwing bags. It doesn't matter. Well, it does matter.
Now, I just had a flashback to 25 years ago. Many of you recall the crash of the Concorde in Paris. And that was because the initiating event was there was some, what's called FOD, some debris left from a previous aircraft that was on the runway. The Concorde tire ran over it, and the debris from the tire hit the fuel tank. One thing led to another, and the plane crashed shortly thereafter. And I'm willing to bet that, you know, whoever's responsible for making sure the runway was clean wasn't certificated by the French version of the FAA. But they were absolutely essential for the safe operation of not just the Concorde, but any airplane on that at that airport. So moving on to the next question. This is from a recent show that we did. This is from an event where a pilot was getting their night currency and made a few decisions about that that ended up in a tragic loss of the aircraft and both himself and the passenger on board. As we pointed out during this particular episode, the pilot was already in violation because they were taking a passenger on board when they were not authorized to do so. Charles Foray, 1189, should there be a pre-flight checklist for passengers with pilots who should be required to go through with them? Because the passenger was not a pilot. Passenger was apparently a friend of this person. And they probably thought, hey, a friend who's a pilot, he's been flying for a while, wants to take me flying at night, it might be fun. Turned out to be tragic. Because the person wrote the commenter, few passengers even know the signs of pilot laxness, incompetence, or irresponsibility, which can show up before the airplane even leaves the ground. Failure to check the weather, lack of qualifications for flying at night or bad weather, lack of currency, lack of experience in the particular aircraft. The question I saw within that is, should there be a pre-flight checklist for passengers on a general aviation flight, the kind of airplane I fly?
Would you appreciate that a friend of yours comes up, you're going to fly with them for the first time, they whip out this checklist and start grilling you on all of these things before you fly? You may be on the ground an extra hour trying to answer these questions before they decide whether or not they trust you.
I was just, as you were reading that, I was thinking back when I was 14 years old, hanging around in the airport. And I would fly with, I washed airplanes. I did all sorts of things to fly with these guys. I never asked. I never was concerned with whether or not they were qualified. I wanted to fly with them. I wanted to get some time on the stick. Right? And that activity actually helped me solo very quickly when I finally got instructors, because I had already flown so much with all these other people, just taking rides with them. But I never once thought about their qualifications. They had an airplane, and they were going to go flying, and I had the opportunity to go with them.
That's why he never questioned the Wright brothers when he was flying with them. So
I knew I wouldn't escape. As soon as I raised that, I knew I was going to get killed.
Now, I mean, it could be a valid question. It's not going to be a valid question or basically a solution. For people that get on a commercial airliner, you're not going to go up and interview the crew. However, if you are flying with an acquaintance or a colleague or whatever, I don't think you need to whip out a checklist, but you can ask some basic questions. How long have you been flying? About how much time or how much time do you have? And things like that. But again, I don't care if the guy goes, well, I've had the airplane 20 years. I got 5,000 hours in the airplane. They'll still kill you if they do stupid, things in the air or make a bad decision where we got to get to this meeting and the weather's lousy at the other end, but I've got this airplane and I've flown in this kind of weather before. Just sit back, relax, hold my beer and watch this. It's one of those gut feeling kind of things. It's like talking to a friend who just bought a Ferrari after they've been driving a Volkswagen for the last 20 years. And they go, hey, let's go for a ride. Are you really going to just jump in because they just got the car? You know they have zero experience in this car and they want to go take you for a ride and they're going to show you what the car can do. It's kind of that kind of analogy where, I mean, you have to have that comfort level because as a pilot, yeah, we want to impress our friends or our family or our colleagues or whatever and say that we can do this and I've got this amount of experience, but we as an accident investigators have seen it historically and had to investigate it where, I mean, you get a family who gets in the airplane with dad and they know that dad's been flying forever and it's their airplane, but dad puts them in a compromising position and then dad unfortunately loses that airplane and kills his whole family. It's a hard question to really answer. It's more about what's your comfort level with that person. Asking basic questions, they're going to give you answers. But unless you know what the context of that answer is, like, I mean, we don't measure experience in years. I could be flying 20 years and only have 200 hours. Well, it's not like being an accountant with 20 years of experience. It's hours. And a 200-hour pilot is not as experienced as a 2,000-hour pilot or a 20,000-hour pilot. So unless there's an education program for the general public to really understand all of that kind of thing, asking questions of this person, especially somebody that, okay, yeah, I work with this guy. He said he can fly us. You know, you can ask all the questions you want. It's all about the comfort level. And a lot of it is, I mean, what's that person like at work? Are they reckless? Are they, you know, footloose, fancy free? Are they very strict? Are they very operationally disciplined? Because that's what's going to translate when you get into the airplane. Because most likely if they're, you know, happy-go-lucky, you know, yeah, whatever, you know, we'll make things happen. That attitude typically will carry over into the airplane.
Now, on that point, I've been on both sides of the equation as someone who was flying with a friend or a colleague and someone who took passengers up. In both cases, I'd actually had some experience, even way back when, with being around airplanes, being around checklists and such. So I asked some very basic questions. And like you said, if this is someone you know from work or from wherever, and you don't like the way their attitude is that day, or you wouldn't ride with them in a Lamborghini, if they have that sort of attitude, it's like, okay, I don't know what's wrong with this person, but I'm not riding in the car with him today. Use that same mentality when it comes to airplanes. And on the pilot side, I would just take some time to, you know, tell them what we're going to do, what to expect, and if they had any questions or, you know, hesitation, speak up. And even if we're about to get in the airplane and strap in and say, I don't want to fly, I'd honor that. And I'd tell them ahead of time, hey, it's up to you. Now, whether or not, you know, that's something that you want to do for yourself, it's up to you. But again, you don't have to be an expert as a passenger to ask a basic question. If you don't like the answer, walk away.
Yep. No, that's great advice.
Now, moving on to another question entirely. This is from episode 294, where we talked about I'm going to get the right title for this. This was a powered lift aircraft, the Revo light sport aircraft, which was a gyrocopter looking aircraft, which had a very experienced pilot who was training someone else to fly this aircraft. This pilot missed a basic checklist item and the wings folded in flight. The aircraft crashed and they were both killed. And from Dermick, who asked this question, I wonder if there's some design changes. Oh, by the way, there was a checklist item that involved making sure that the wing of this aircraft was properly connected and structurally sound. That particular step did not happen, and the aircraft was not able to fly. His question was, I wonder if there's some design changes in this aircraft that could reduce the risk of forgetting a critical checklist item, assuming that's what happened here. Something like a big red flag with a skull and crossbones that says, if you forget this thing, you will have a very bad day. It seems like this is a very preventable tragedy. My heart goes out to all those affected. The question inside of that I saw was, can you make design changes in an aircraft to reduce the risk of forgetting a checklist item?
First off, you can't idiot-proof any aircraft. I mean, because you'd have all of these things on an airplane or a helicopter or a balloon or whatever that, again, you can't think of all the things that a responsible pilot should do to ensure that their aircraft is airworthy and ready to fly. Look, glider pilots take the wings off their airplane all the time. They put them back on. There are quick disconnects. They're very simple devices. But if you don't do a thorough, proper pre-flight of those items, especially those flight safety critical items, with flight controls, wings, tail, whatever, you're going to have a very bad day. And that's why John preaches it at the end of our regular shows about thorough pre-flight and really understanding your aircraft. I've done a number of accidents, glider accidents and ultralights, where pilots, they got into this mentality of kick the tire, light the fire, I want to go fly, and just done a very cursory pre-flight. And unfortunately, bad things do happen. Now, if you don't have a lot of experience, that's one thing. In this case, you had an experienced pilot teaching another pilot. That should have slowed the whole process down, because as a flight instructor, you walk around the aircraft teaching all of the things that you want that student to know are safety critical. This is what we got to do. Here's the checklist item. I point to it. I touch it. I look at it. I examine it. It's good to go. Or, oh, wow, this is not proper. We're not going. That apparently didn't take place. And again, you can only idiot-proof a machine so much. I mean, cars are very safe today, yet we still find ways to crash a car. Same with the aircraft. It is up to the human. It is up to the pilot to take that responsibility as pilot in command and take it seriously and do all the necessary things that will ensure the highest levels of operational safety and airworthiness of the aircraft. Worst comes to worst, you don't trust yourself, then you do all the things you think are necessary and then have another pilot come in behind you, another set of eyes. But that's not practical.
Issue of putting something together when you're alone, mechanics have to do that all the time. I was taught that if you, under those circumstances, you walk away from the job, maybe go get a cup of coffee, but you take a break for a few minutes and then come back and inspect your own work. Or, like you said, get somebody else to come over and take a look for you. I don't know how many times that I've, in all the years that I worked, that somebody called me over to take a look at what they had just done. You know, and usually it was the ones that, where there was hidden pieces, where it was technical and you couldn't always see your hands and what they were doing. But you always need to have that in the back of your mind. Did I do it properly? And what can I do to ensure that it was done properly? To keep you out of trouble. So it's the second look, whether you do the second look or you bring somebody else over to do the second look, just to double check what you've done. It only takes a couple minutes, just a few minutes for somebody to come over and take a look. Because a lot of the mistakes, pretty simple, pretty simple. And on the pre-flights, you know, we sort of go over it a little bit lightly, but the quality of the pre-flights, you know, I looked at a couple yesterday done by airline personnel, and they weren't too bad. But I've seen them, airline personnel, do walk-arounds that weren't too good. You know, yeah. Stuff on the ramp, lavatory trucks maybe have spilled stuff. You know, I've seen blue fluid and other things on the ramp that pilots won't do their walk around in that area because they don't want to walk through it. It hasn't been cleaned up yet. I mean, there's all kinds. Rainy day, puddles. You know, they don't have rubber boots. You know, so they're not going to get their feet wet and have to live with that for the rest of the day. They will walk around them more concerned with the puddle than looking at the airplane. Why? Because we get some complacency. They almost never find something wrong with their airplane. You know, when you do an inspection over and over and over again and don't find anything, well, then your expectation is that you're not going to find anything. And that's not the right way. That pre-flight, I can't tell you how many accidents that Todd and I go through where pre-flight is definitely a factor in it. It may not have even caused a crash, but it was a factor in it because it led to, it was one of the steps early on that led to bigger problems.
So, before we go to our last question, just one quick question for John here. You know, blue is my favorite color, and if I see blue fluid, I'm thinking bright, sunny day in the summertime. So why should I be afraid if I were a pilot with expensive Italian custom-made shoes walking through blue fluid? What could possibly go wrong? So no need to answer that because we're running short on time, because we want to go to the last question. This is from episode 272, which was an unusual show for us because it featured only one of us. And that was you, Greg, where you gave a presentation about aviation safety, which I highly recommend you go see. It's an excellent presentation. This was to, I believe, maintenance professionals, but anyone in aviation would gain a lot of insight from that. And Mr. John M. Hancock, 1503, not related to the other guy, I assume. I enjoyed the presentation, particularly integration of human factors and SMS, that safety management system. With the development of SMS, maybe it's my perception, aviation organizations place a greater emphasis on SMS at the expense of human factors. Neither mutually exclusive, or rather, human factors and SMS are complementary to one another, sharing a common denominator, a human. The question I saw in that was, do safety programs put too much emphasis on SMS and not enough emphasis on human factors? Take it away, Greg.
When we look at what an SMS program is, we've been performing the elements of an SMS program since we've been flying aircraft of any kind. And it's just in the recent past where we've taken these elements, pulled them all together, and then coined them into this thing called safety management system. And for you to build an effective program, a safety management system program, you not only have to develop the elements for your particular operation, but then you have to train people for the recognition to fulfill what these elements are. When we look at human factors is a very vanilla term. What is human factors? Well, you go to an aviation psychologist, they'll give you one definition. You go to the FAA, what human factors are, the FAA will give you a different definition. It's very squishy. These are the soft skill stuff that make up these differences. But right now, especially in commercial operations where, and this doesn't apply just to aircraft operation, but it does apply to airports, flight schools, things like that, where again, SMS program is a program. It does have elements of tasks that need to be trained to the human. Human factors involves those things that affect decision-making, tactile skills, actions, inactions, things like that. I incorporate both of them because you cannot have an effective SMS program. It's not worth the paper it's written on unless you have 100% buy-in by every single human. You have one human that says, I'm not doing that, then they have an adverse effect on the success of those programs. So as a flight instructor, my job is to try and identify these things that affect decision-making, because that's really a big deficiency, whether you fly it, fix it, or manage it. And I would encourage everyone, pilots, mechanics, flight attendants, even managers, to pull FAA Advisory Circular 60-22, which is produced by the FAA, and it's all about aeronautical decision-making, ADM. Because it has outstanding information that not only applies to aviation itself, but there are a lot of life lessons. And I preach it all the time. Everything we do in aviation is a life lesson. Everything in life is an aviation lesson. You can't just turn safety on and off. It's not a switch. And so it's incumbent that you have to really understand why people, not pilots, not mechanics, not flight, why people either make good decisions, bad decisions, what influences those decisions, because that's what affects a successful outcome or an adverse outcome. So I try to incorporate it in all my safety presentations because, like our viewers said, they go hand in hand. You cannot separate them. They are not in a silo.
So, and that's a perfect segue for me to plug my book I'm co-author on, Safety Management Systems and Aviation. Perfect place. And that it really is about measuring what goes on in aviation. And I push on maintenance departments all the time. Every time an airplane comes back to the gate for a maintenance issue, we should be exploring why that maintenance issue came up. We don't always do that. We measure components for their reliability. We need to measure our people for their reliability. And that would expose to training and all those other pieces that we often talk about on the show as being causal for accidents or business. So, I mean, we're supposed to fit like a hand in a glove. We don't always do it.
Well, John, I thank you for taking this opportunity, out of the blue to promote your book. But I will not promote a book. What I'm going to promote is this podcast. And for those of you looking at the video version of this, you'll see all the various ways that you can join the channel, subscribe, give us a like, give us a comment, share this video with your friends, family, and colleagues. And if you happen to see us live in the future, you can comment live on the show. If not, you can send us email like we have in the link here. And with that, I'd like to you can email us. I forgot about that. Email us at flysafetydetectives@gmail.com. We don't do TikTok. We don't do that other stuff. Email is the original social media. It's old. It's good. It's reliable. Email us. We'll get back to you. And now I'd like to have you, Greg, talk about
One of our sponsors is ProChox. You've seen me in past shows actually wearing the chocks around my neck. They are a great product. I use them on my aircraft, and I encourage other folks to use them. They're very well built. You can get a variety of different sizes and colors of the ProChox, and in fact, you can get them embossed with anything you want. I have the name of the aviation company on one set of them. I have the end registration number on another set of chalks. They're outstanding. And in fact, the ones that I typically throw in the airplane are small, but they're effective. They're lightweight, and they aren't going to add to the useful, gross weight of my airplane by anything. So we really, love those ProChox. I use them on my aircraft. And again, using chalks is absolutely necessary, especially when you got an airplane parked on a ramp. And regardless of whether you've tied it down or not, those chalks are going to keep the airplane from moving. That's why the insurance companies love making sure that we as pilots make sure our airplanes are safe. And in that case, when I have my airplane insured by Avemco, which is our primary sponsor on this particular show, we hear about some ground accidents that take place, and a lot of it can be attributed to basic ramp safety. And part of ramp safety is ProChalks or using chalks on your aircraft. But Avemco, they've been a very long-term sponsor. Actually, they've been a sponsor since the initiation of this show. I have all of my aircraft over the years insured by Avemco. They also carry my CFI insurance and my renter's insurance. So if you are in need of aircraft insurance or supplemental insurance like CFI insurance, renter insurance, definitely reach out to Avemco. Mention that you watch our show or listen to our show, and you'll get a 5% discount. They have been an outstanding sponsor. I loved working with them. I've had several claims in the past with my aircraft. There's never been a question. They have been very responsive, and I've gotten the airplane fixed as necessary almost immediately. So if you're looking for insurance, go to Avemco. And with that, gentlemen, I'm going to close us out because I love these live versions. But again, we could go on and on and on, and we don't have time to do that. But as Todd said, send us more money and we will get a green screen. If you send us a lot of money, we'll actually have a studio. So we want to thank you all for being here today, watching our show, supporting us, and keep those comments coming via email so we can bring it to you on Fridays and answer those questions.